And that's the kicky music that means it is time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. No time is the wrong time to talk about America's every dad, Tom Hanks. He's back in the new film, Captain Phillips, and we'll talk about the man, the film, and the choppy, choppy water. As if we won't be damp enough at that point, this week we're taking on pop culture that makes us cry. And as always, we'll close with what's making us happy this week. Before we get started here in non-historic Studio 46, let's go around the table. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Trey Graham, what do you do at NPR?
I cover movies and theater and whatnot for NPR.
Glenn Weldon is off sunburning the top of his head, as he has indicated on Twitter. We are joined here in the studio by the originator of the phrase, America's every dad, to my knowledge, Chris Klimek. Chris Klimek, it's good to see you.
Hello, it is lovely to be here.
And Chris, what do you do when you are not appearing as a guest on NPR? What kinds of things should we know about you?
I'm a writer about town for the city paper and the Village Voice, Slate now.
Writer about town.
Movies and plays and that sort of stuff.
That's rad. Well, it's wonderful to see you. Some of you may remember Chris from past shows about boxing and punching and action movies and even some other things.
Getting pigeonholed. I was going to say, I think of Chris as our boxing coach on call.
I know.
Particularly when robots are involved.
It's true, but Chris doesn't like to be pigeonholed. In this case, he's here partly because Chris and I went to see Captain Phillips together, and as we sometimes do, go to the movies. I think this might be one of the first ones we've gone to that hasn't been like, well, we did see Fast and Furious 6, for example. We will actually be putting up an essay on the blog today. It is Tuesday, that Chris wrote about the action in Captain Phillips. Chris, why don't you explain a little bit about the thesis of that piece?
Well, the idea was, I always wonder how, to what extent I should be enjoying these kind of reality-based adventure films, of which I think this is a very responsible and well-made specimen. But of course, we know from the real episode this is based on that this hostage situation was resolved by the intervention of the Navy SEALs, who turn up a lot in these kinds of movies. They're prominent in Zero Dark Thirty. But I always just wonder, since this is a real episode in which people really died, just those competing responsibilities to make an exciting film that's going to interest audiences but be somewhat reasonably true to the events as they occurred.
Right.
And what are my obligations as an audience member? Like, should I complain, oh, this is boring, you know, if they're being too detail-oriented,
right,
if they're being too close to the truth, if they're not compressing enough? All things, as we'll get into, I think Captain Phillips does quite well, quite responsibly. But that's basically what the piece is about.
If you don't know the story, Captain Phillips is basically about an American cargo ship that was sailing near Somalia when a group of Somali pirates came on board, hijacked the ship, and eventually wound up taking the captain of the ship, who's played in the movie by Hanks, hostage in a lifeboat. And if you're thinking of lifeboat like a little inflatable raft, which I think many of us do, this is more like it's almost like a little subby type thing.
Yeah, it's enclosed. It's got a dome across the top.
It's like an orange boot.
It seats about 20. Yeah, it looks like a big orange boot, and it floats. But it's got like 20 seats. It's a good size lifeboat.
Yeah.
This is such a strange and compelling movie. And it's three or four different kinds of movies, right?
Yeah.
It's this big scale military movie. It's this tiny little movie about people trapped in a confined space with no way out.
Right.
And it's this movie about people hiding from people stalking them.
Yeah.
And it is ruthlessly efficient.
Yeah.
And I was on the edge of my seat the whole time, even though I knew exactly how it was going to
end. Right. And we should mention, in terms of spoilers, it's always difficult with a movie like this,
right,
because it is a real story. And not only a real story, but a real story that a lot of people know.
Well, a real story that happened within the last 5 years.
Right.
And as short as our collective memories are.
So don't be shocked if we mention that he lived, because it's based on his book. and for him to live, I can't really talk about this movie without talking about the fact that in the end what happened is they shot the pirates who had him on the ship. And I know that Chris and I, when the screening that Chris and I were at, I was rather surprised and a little affronted by the fact that when the guys got shot in the head, there was a little like football-like cheer from a small group of people in the theater.
Just a little one, though. And there's always going to be somebody like that.
But I don't feel like that's the movie's fault.
Absolutely not.
I feel like the movie gives a particularly balanced view of the motives of everyone involved.
It's certainly trying to, I think.
And I've seen criticism of the film that has suggested that it is deifying Captain Phillips as this incredibly brave character. And to me, you know, we talked last week about gravity, and I described it as space peril. This is just sea ordeal. it's this very gripping, as somebody said, very efficiently told story of just this awful thing this guy goes through.
Yeah.
And in part because they are tethered to real events, it's not a tale of derring do, really. There are occasional bits of derring do in it, as there would be.
Yeah.
But it's largely like, what do you do in this terrible situation? Right. And then at a certain point, it is, what does anyone do in this terrible situation, including the pirates? And I think, unlike a lot of action movies, and this is only so much an action movie, the problem gets bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger until it's solved. What I found interesting about this movie, and what they were forced to do with this movie, is that everything gets smaller and smaller
and tighter
and more contained and with fewer options.
Yeah, that's very true.
Yeah, and as the emotion ramps up.
Yeah,
right, and you wonder, like, were they not bound to follow these events as they unfolded in reality? That's probably not a choice that a screenwriter would have made, but being forced by circumstance to follow that, it's great.
And I loved that about it. And I had the same reaction to Argo, where because it is based on a thing, you know, they certainly dramatized it and fictionalized elements of it, but this movie doesn't have a countdown clock. You know, it doesn't have, like, they snip the blue wire with 0.1 seconds left. I mean, they build in a lot of, you know, fairly typical signifiers of action. We can talk about the military stuff separately. I found the military stuff, to me, by far the least interesting component of this movie.
Though it's
a necessity. For one thing, you have the most generic military score tacked over any scene involving the military, where it's where it suddenly becomes this less interesting movie, and then it's a more interesting movie again.
Yeah. I do actually think, before we get too far away from the idea of the score, there were parts of the movie that I really liked, in particular the bits where the pirates are chasing this massive container ship in their little skiffs. Whoever wrote the score is doing some very smart work with these little chattery noises in the strings and maybe in the brass and the woodwinds. And then you'll hear this gigantic sort of wah, wah from the brass that's clearly like the sound of the ship happening in the orchestra. Mm-hmm. And it was really, really smart. And, you know, I don't know that most audiences will notice that, but they will absolutely be moved and steered.
They will notice the effect. I say this as a huge fan of the James Bond franchise. That scene is the only exciting boat chase in any movie, right?
Well, and again, when you talk about being bound by real events, it's so interesting because when you see these two vessels, right, out on the water,
this is your final warning. Stop the ship.
It is kind of an amazing moment when you realize that this gigantic, expensive cargo ship is terrified to death of basically this little fishing boat because it happens to have a bunch of guys with guns on it.
Shots fired! Shots fired! Hit the hoses!
It is sort of amazing. I think one of the things that makes it a good boat chase, and one of the few, I would agree with Chris, I haven't seen as many boat chases as Chris, but one of the few...
Don't feel bad about it.
One of the few chases I can remember.
4 knots! And like 8 seconds later, 3 knots! It's like this slow motion. Oh my God. God,
who knew Thompson
had
a speed? Who knew Thompson had a speed?
I have not even seen speed.
Oh, it's terrible.
But one of the things that makes it interesting is that it is this unusual array of vessels, a little tiny ship that's a threat to a great big huge ship. And when you realize, again, you talked about limited options, how limited the big ship's options are for what it's going to do to prevent men in a faster, smaller boat with guns from getting on board.
In a way, like, did anybody see the awful photos of, I believe it's an eagle killing a deer?
Yes.
And it's just, how does an eagle take a deer? It's a little bit like that. The eagle has talons.
Yeah.
Yep. And so it did have this, you know, tenacity of this gigantic insect bugging around the ship.
It's this gigantic cargo ship, and its defenses are limited essentially to swerve!
Swerve and right. spray water.
Right. And those limited defenses are what make it a more interesting scene. Although, right. you know, of course, I think I even leaned over to Linda while this is going on. I was like, they really don't have any firearms of any kind on the... So I went home and read about this. And of course, now the Maersk Alabama has a permanent armed security staff that travel on the ship that has apparently repelled at least three subsequent hijacking attempts after the one depicted in this movie.
Yeah. One of the things that has come up in the aftermath of this movie is that a bunch of the guys who were sailors on that ship have a lawsuit that's been pending against, I guess, the ship company.
The Maersk. Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that they say, they have a lot of beefs about the captain. And one of the things that they are alleging in the lawsuit, a bunch of those things have to do with him being kind of a jerk and not listening to warnings. And so they have a whole different way of looking at this, partly undoubtedly that comes from their experience and partly undoubtedly that comes from their attorney. So there have been a lot of accusations about, like, the movie is inaccurate because he's not such a hero and he didn't. Like, there seems to be an allegation in a bunch of these pieces that the movie claims that he, like, became a hostage on purpose.
Which it doesn't
show that. But it doesn't at all.
It certainly does not portray it that way.
What happens in the movie is what I understand them to be saying happened in real life, which is one of the things that I like about the movie, is that he's not really a hero. He goes as far as, you know, when he gets on the lifeboat, it's for the purpose of he's going to tell them how to operate it and they're going to leave. And then they kind of abscond with him. And this much is in the trailer, right? They just kind of, they break the deal and they flee. He never had any intention of going away with them on the lifeboat. The reason I bring this up is because one of the things I like about the movie is that if he weren't Tom Hanks, and this is one of the things that's also in Chris's piece, if it weren't Tom Hanks, the fact that it's Tom Hanks is doing 98% of the heroizing
yes,
work that's
totally.
In this movie. Other than that, one of the things I love about his acting in this movie is that this guy, especially once he's on the lifeboat, is terrified
yes.
the entire time. He is not stoic.
Right.
He is terrified. And there is a moment when he attempts to escape.
Right.
And one of the things I said to Chris was, it's really easy to look at that as he's trying to escape because he's terrified to death of these pirates. He's also trying to escape because he's terrified of the Navy.
Yeah.
He knows that what he tells them is true. They would rather sink this with all of us on it than let you get away. He knows that whatever is going to go down between the Navy and the pirates,
He wants no part.
He's just as afraid of whatever the Navy is going to do at that point as he is of what the pirates are going to do.
Without giving away too many specifics, there are two or three things that happen that make it clear that he is communicating clearly enough with the Navy. The Navy has given him a couple of high signs, and he's given them a couple of high signs, and he knows exactly what they're going to do.
Right.
And he is... chicken.
He is chicken in a human way.
He is chicken in exactly the human way that says, oh my God, there is going to be a hail of gunfire coming this way.
Here's another thing I like about this movie. And you know, I said before, it's like it gets smaller and smaller. The confines get smaller and smaller. I also think, in a way, the stakes get smaller and smaller. And that this ultimately becomes a story... Yes, it's will these pirates be brought to justice or whatever, but ultimately, by the end, the stakes are... How does this guy live?
Right.
It's not, does he manage to single-handedly save the pirates from detonating an atomic bomb? And in a way, that really varies from a lot of action movies, where there's always this, like, you know, when we talked
save
about...
Save the Earth.
When we talked about Olympus Has Fallen, it's like there's carnage to prevent more carnage.
Yeah.
This is just trying to prevent this one dude from dying. That's the only stakes for him at that point.
In another way, and I think in a very important way, for him... You're right. The legit real-world stakes, in terms of material things anyway, and his own life, they get smaller and smaller. But in a very important way, they get bigger and bigger. At a certain point, all he's trying to do is get out alive and, if at all possible, save the life of this young, dumb pirate who signed on for this mission without knowing what he was getting into.
Sure. And I think one of the things that the film is working hard on is trying to make sure that you understand that although nobody is making any excuses for piracy as a way of making money, you really are looking at guys who, from the opening of the film, are threatened themselves with guns and
are essentially coerced into taking
this mission. Are told you have to go do this. And so, although you don't necessarily, it's not like you think it's an okay thing to do, you also are really driven, I think, to have some level of sympathy for how desperate their straits are also.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think there's something sort of appealingly 1970s. I might be quoting my own piece now. I'm not sure. But the way that this movie doesn't really editorialize, I mean, I've seen pieces arguing that it's right-wing and pro-military and, you know, pieces arguing that it's too dovish and liberal. And I really feel like it, you know, it's a Rorschach blot where, I mean, it will reflect back at you whatever your own beliefs and prejudices are. But one of the films I kept thinking of a little bit was Dog Day Afternoon, actually, in the way that it really sympathizes these two hijackers, or not hijackers, bank robbers who, you know, end up in this hostage situation basically because they're not hard-hearted enough or calculating enough to pull off this robbery that they attempt. And it's, you know, these hijackers, they're not particularly good criminals. They're motivated by desperation.
Although it's clear that your sympathies are with the captain, it's a terrible situation for everyone, which is why I was so surprised that there was that little group of people who seemed to think that you were supposed to be like, woo, Navy SEALs, great. Like, I mean, yes, you are in the sense that you're supposed to admire their marksmanship, but it's a terrible situation. Like, it's very sad.
I think it's very much the movie's credit that they are presented as people who come in as specialists. They do what they're asked to do. They do it very well. And there's not a whole lot of backslapping or, you know, there's not a lot of rah-rah.
Yeah, there's not necessarily this, like, you know, the control room of people high-fiving and cheering.
And can we just talk about that last scene that Hanks plays with woman
and let's
who's
not give
taking
away
care of him? I think that scene indicates a lot of what I really loved about this movie, which is that he is not a fearless person. He is not a superhuman. He is very, very deeply human and very deeply affected by all of this.
Yeah. The way a somewhat regular person would be. And I always think putting regular, you know, action movies, again, not that this is a pure action movie, but action movies in which a relatively regular person is put in extraordinary circumstances are to me always more interesting than a superhuman of some kind.
Yeah.
We should at some point, however, talk about Tom Hanks's accent.
I don't know. I heard so much complaining about it.
Yeah,
it did not bother me at all.
I am almost never bothered by outrageous accents. For some reason, Kevin Costner and Robin Hood didn't bother me. Troy is a terrible movie, but not because the accents are
the only annoying thing I can tell you. We will link to this, but our own producer Nick Fountain, I don't know if you guys know this, but Nick actually produced a piece for Morning Edition about Boston accents specifically.
Well, and Nick would know.
Of course. And how hard they are to do well and why they always sound terrible.
Well, it did. And for a while, it was like, is he playing, was it Rich Phillips or is he playing Diamond Joe Quimby?
Indy, a spirit of the occasion, I must tell you what I think. You two screwed up royal.
Well, yeah, it's very easy for your
I want answers.
Well, like it takes exactly, you know, the length of that very problematic for reasons other than the accent first scene with Catherine Keener.
It's a rough scene.
For you to sort of adjust to it. Yeah, the movie would have been better off without that little goofy
prologue. For one thing, that really needed Tar Ariano wig cop for those of you who follow Tar
Ariano. That was my first thought, is who put poor Catherine Keener in this awful wig?
Right, so I mean, do we think that there were other scenes of Catherine Keener surrounded by family back home watching television
got
cut?
I hope so. I like to think there were.
I want to say that I saw a trailer for this 1,000 years ago with Tom Hanks on the phone with her.
Oh, could be.
But I'm not positive.
And we've got enough. I mean, I think like one of the things that's so great about Gravity, and I know that the studio wanted from Alfonso Cuarón, was that, you know, they wanted those scenes back on Earth, and I think the movie is much stronger without them.
Right.
Yeah.
And I felt the first couple minutes of this movie, and I think advice for people seeing this movie is just power through those first few minutes because I sat there thinking, I thought this was supposed to be good.
Yeah.
Yeah, it doesn't really get going until they're on the ship.
It's definitely
Which doesn't take terribly long.
It's a very awkward and odd first scene. But the rest of the movie, I like.
And we should, if we're going to talk about Tom Hanks and Catherine Keener, we should really talk at least a little about Barkhad Abdi.
Hey!
Look at me.
Sure.
Look at me.
Sure.
I'm the captain now.
who is 27-year-old actor who plays the sort of main pirate.
The main pirate that he interacts
and
with.
And who is phenomenal.
Amazing.
Yeah. Just
he's
first
really
of all,
terrific.
The kind of face and physiognomy and presence you do not see very
that
often
is absolutely
on a
true.
Hollywood
right. that
screen.
That is absolutely true.
Right, just super skinny and different. It's
this isn't
no
like
other
we
way
got Idris
say
Elba
it.
To try to look
right.
like a Somali pirate.
And just this guy is actually a 27-year-old Somali native who moved here. I'm cheating now from an LA Times article, but he moved from Somalia to Yemen at 7 and then to Minneapolis at 14, where he learned English from listening to Jay-Z.
Minneapolis.
And Seinfeld.
Minneapolis has a huge Somali community.
That's why he kept punctuating all the sentences. I can't do it.
But no, he's terrific. I'm glad you brought that up because he's really excellent. All right, well, if you saw Captain Phillips or if you didn't, come and find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH and tell us what you think of Tom Hanks, America's Every Dad, or wonderful young Somali actors that we haven't seen before. So when we realized that Glenn Weldon was not going to be here this week, we thought, what would be a perfect topic to cover in the absence of Glenn? What can we do when the cat is away?
When the emotional cat is away.
Yes.
What can we do?
The emotionless cat.
And we realized, first of all, Stephen put out a call.
Yeah, I put out a call on Facebook, facebook.com/PCHH. Put out a call, hey, you guys like topics?
We sometimes can't think of
we
any.
We sometimes can't think of any. We've been a little, you know, we've been a little dry lately on the topics. And so I put out a call, and at last I looked, 341 comments and counting, including, I counted about 80 that are usable, which is kind of staggering.
Yeah, it's a very good average.
Yeah.
So this was one of them.
This one comes courtesy of Evan Mather. We're not necessarily going to credit every one of these every time, since sometimes people suggested the same thing twice.
And the topic suggestion was?
Pop culture that makes us cry. And why.
And why. All right, so I want to start this segment with a little shout out to my mother.
Oh, sure.
Oh, my. Crying on it.
Okay, so this is the Carousel Waltz, for those of you who don't know, from the Rodgers and Hammerstein musical Carousel. And my mother is laughing right now. She knows why I'm playing this, because of the many things that my mother and I have both cried about while watching them. She has this thing about Carousel, and therefore, as soon as you hear that waltz, she will just feel herself begin to give herself over to Carousel.
Oh.
And we've talked about that and that kind of visceral sense that now you're entering the realm of crying.
Yep.
So that's my entree into the realm of crying.
Oh, my God. I have exactly that topic for you.
Yes. Well, Trey, why don't you kick us off?
Well, that's not going to be it. I want to come back. That one's my third one. I have a build here. I have a build.
Oh,
of course you do.
I only brought one handkerchief.
I came up with three particular instances in which I have actually cried, either in a theater or in a movie theater.
Yes, I did my best to stick to things that I actually cry, not that are the kind of things I would tell you I would cry at.
But I wanted to try to extrapolate principles from those.
Sure.
So the first one I came up with is the scene in Sense and Sensibility wherein Edward Ferrers finally reveals to Eleanor Dashwood that he is still on the market and still interested. And Eleanor Dashwood, played by...
Emma Thompson.
She's kind of poleaxed for a second.
Then you... are not married.
And then she just cracks.
No.
All of the composure, all of the amazing composure that she showed throughout this whole movie, this whole wonderfully contained, constricted movie, she just loses it. She cracks. Comes apart. And it's sadness and joy all at once. And that, for me, is one real sure go-to.
Sure.
When somebody has done the right thing and suffered for it, and finally is rewarded, and there's that sort of eruption, both for the character and for the audience, of sadness and joy together. that is a big button for me.
Wonderful. I was extrapolating some principles also because I realized that, you know, I'll just open with there are certainly some that are just, it's a sad thing, so I cry. That was like when I cried just the other day. I cried at the Glee episode, the memorial episode for Corey Monteith. I cried a lot during that. I cried, like I cried at the beginning of Up.
Yeah, we'll get to that.
Everyone cried at the beginning of Up. And then the classic.
You're going to realize that you love me. And maybe you're going to feel badly because you never told me. But don't. I know that you love me. So don't ever do that to yourself, all right?
Okay.
Okay?
You said okay.
Okay, you two should run along. Take care. Give me a kiss. I was so scared, but I think it went really well, don't you?
That is Deborah Winger saying goodbye to her kids in terms of endearment. I do okay
James
in that
L.
scene.
Brooks.
I do okay in that scene until her littler son is at the door and he's absolutely crying. And he's, you know, this is the last time he's going to see her. And he is the one to whom she says as he's crying and standing at the door, I think that went really well, don't you? And he nods and then he leaves and he's still crying. That is the part where I'm always just like, So those are kind of the straightforward ones. Those are just like, it's
just,
a sad
those are just
thing.
Just pulling your nose hairs.
It's
Did Jeff Daniels
thing.
Do anything after
it's
that movie?
It's a sad thing. It's pulling your nose hairs. So you cry. How about you, Chris Klimek? Do you cry?
Yeah, you know, you announced this topic and you were saying, oh, I'm going to have to narrow it down. And I had exactly that. Like, the list is so short of, wow. of things that I recall crying at that once you apply the Zaxxon rule, the
right.
list is complete. So, so I have two very well-known things and then kind of a deeper cut. Wes Anderson movies. I have a couple of specific ones. You know, the critical conversation about him always seems to center around in the way that he creates these very deliberately artificial sets and environments and seems to direct his actors to give these more muted performances than what we usually get for them. And something about just that turning of the dials, for me at least, seems to push the emotions of these stories to the foreground. The one that most reliably gets me is at the end of my favorite Wes Anderson movie, The Royal Tenenbaums, mm-hmm. when drug-addled Owen Wilson runs over Buckley the Beagle with his car. You know, this is a climactic scene already. It's a wedding scene. Okay, so to very briefly go through the story of this movie, we have the various Tenenbaums who, and, you know, the deadbeat dad played by Gene Hackman.
Right.
And they've all kind of frozen him out with good reason, but none of them more coldly than Ben Stiller, who is grieving, you know, for a recent widower and refuses to speak to him at all. And the one successful attempt that Royal, the character Gene Hackman plays, has made to reconnect with any member of his family are with his two grandsons, Ben Stiller's kids. Like, that seems like a sincere relationship where all the other ones are kind of selfish and false. But Ben Stiller wants none of it. And then, you know, finally, he brings over this Dalmatian, this dog that he has procured from just a conveniently passing fireman. You know, I got you a new dog for the boys. Actually, I think we have a clip of this.
What's his name?
Sparkplug.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
The place where I lose it is the line, I've had a tough year.
I've had a rough year, Dad.
I don't know you have, Chazzy.
Oh, here we go. So a lot of this surely is the Mark Mothersbaugh music here. Mm-hmm. And really,
nice,
you know, I think all of the ones that I've identified from movies, it is sort of this, you know, insidious combination.
That's
of,
a very
of,
shimmery little score.
Yes. Mm-hmm. The other one from Wes Anderson's next movie, the less universally beloved Life Aquatic. But again, it's the finale of the movie where they find the jaguar shark that Bill Murray has been chasing with Ahab-like devotion. And again, it's an intentionally, you know, phony-looking special effect, but
sure.
but still sort of beautiful and, you know, in that style. And there's that Sigur Rós song playing that, and it's the one that everybody knows. Like, I can't pronounce the title. But yes, when they're all sort of in awe of the sight of the jaguar shark, and Bill Murray reaches over and rests his hand on Cate Blanchett's pregnant belly, and she says, kind of apropos of nothing,
in 12 years he'll be 11 and a half.
In 12 years he'll be 11 and a half. And Bill Murray says, that was my favorite age.
That was my favorite age.
Aww.
And it's a funny line, but it makes you cry.
It's
I don't know why.
It's wonderful. wonderful. I like it. I like it. So those are your two. Those are your two Wes Anderson movies.
Those are my two. Wes Anderson. Right. Are we going to go around?
I'll get back to you.
Okay.
All right, Crier.
No,
all right.
No.
All right, Stephen Thompson.
This is why they call me Mr. Stoic. Mm-hmm. I'm just staring at a blank piece of paper.
Stephen's doing a little visual joke.
Yeah, it looks like the Rosetta Stone, what he's holding up.
Yeah, let me... Yeah.
No.
Snap a photo.
Ramblings of a madman.
Ramblings of a madman. The sheet of paper at the top says, "Things that make me cry."
Uh-huh.
Oh, and this is this is largely exclusive to popular culture.
Right. As opposed to all the other things that make
me cry. As opposed to my daily life.
Life.
The first 10 minutes of Up. Thinking about the first 10 minutes of Up. 5 minutes before the end of virtually every movie. The scene in Buffy the Vampire Slayer where the school gives her a little umbrella and thanks her for being class protector. Reading the Giving Tree out loud. Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, parentheses, all. You Are Lisa Simpson, most of the things on that one BuzzFeed list.
Oh, God.
The end of this one live version of Jeff Buckley's Hallelujah, where he gets done and one woman screams and then the whole place explodes. Jim and Pam's wedding in the office, when the guy yells, "The Lombardi Trophy's coming home," in the Packer highlight video, the movie The Descendants, Nick Drake's song From the Morning, and every AT&T commercial that played it. My son scoring a goal in hockey in gym class yesterday.
Zach's on rule.
It gets better videos, parentheses all. Linda's essay about oddballs. When the curtain opens in Roger Rabbit and they're bounding into Toontown and Toontown is just enveloping them in all of its gorgeousness. The movie Ghost.
Seriously.
Girl.
No defense against Ghost. The Lion King.
Well, sure.
Wow.
Not to be too Zaxxon-y, but my father died on May 23rd, 1994. And because the universe hates me, The Lion King came out on June 23rd, 1994.
Mm-hmm.
Not a movie that you want to see under those circumstances.
No.
Interestingly enough, those ASPCA ads with the Sarah McLachlan song do nothing for me.
Yeah.
But the one I picked...
I see.
Is the climactic scene in the movie The Iron Giant.
Oh, God, yes. Mm. It's a great one.
When The Iron Giant opened, I went to see it in the theater 3 times in the, 2 weeks that movie was in theaters, mostly so I could sit there and blubber at the climactic
I'm never going to see it because I never stop being enthused about telling you that I haven't seen it and getting you upset all over again.
God, that's one. You know, we all have way more stuff to consume than we can actually consume. That's one that I go back to every 2 years at least, just because it's so good.
And I will eventually,
you need to check in with it every now and again.
But I enjoy
make sure you're
making
still
Thompson
human.
Upset.
I just acquired a loaner copy of that movie, so I will pass it along to you. But there is literally just thinking about it while making this list, I got choked up. And for those who haven't seen the movie, I don't want to really give it away, but there is this absolutely incredible scene where they do this callback of, you know, you are what you choose to be, which is, of course, the lesson of every animated movie ever.
Mm-hmm.
And Vin Diesel-voiced robot says what he has chosen to be, and I just implode every time.
You would.
I always forget that that's Vin Diesel, and good for him.
Oh.
Yeah, you would. All right. So it's interesting. You mentioned the Lion King and your association with the Lion King. That was my next category, was ones where it wouldn't necessarily make you cry, but you associate it with something in particular, either happy or sad, that makes you cry. And I am this way, among other things, about hymns.
Mm-hmm.
Because hymns I associate with various happy occasions, sad occasions, whatever. And one of them is this one.
His eyes, his own. I know God is watching over you and me.
So that is his eyes on the sparrow. That is Mahalia Jackson.
Oh, Mahalia.
And they played, my grandmother liked that hymn, and they played that hymn at my grandmother's funeral. And I think that was the one that years before she died, she made the woman in her church promise, you have to promise to sing this at my funeral, which my grandmother was like that. She planned for her funeral a lot. Which was very funny because my uncle said at one of our visits when she was telling this story, oh, I already told her she has to sing it at my funeral. And he said, she's probably already practicing. Anyway, oh, so that always makes me cry because it just makes me think about my grandma. And so it's those things where it wouldn't necessarily triggers. Have that. Yeah, it's a trigger of a specific memory. Otherwise, I don't know that that would. I mean, it's also sort of one of my favorite scriptural sentiments is the business about the not to worry because God looks over sparrows, even though they don't.
Even though they suck.
Don't. No, they don't fuss. Yeah. They don't fuss, but they're watched over and cared
for. Sometimes
for.
Swoop down and kill deer with their claws. Sparrows.
Yeah, you're all,
the talons of the sparrow.
You're all harshing
small
my.
Small but sharp.
Harshing my biblical mellow. All right, so give me another one, Chris Klinick.
All right, for no particular reason that I can isolate, the LCD Sound System song, Someone Great. James Murphy is an artist who I love working in a genre that I usually do not, but something about the sort of pulsing tempo of the song and the way that the elements come in very gradually, xylophones and this sort of electronically generated bass line over this lyric that seems to sketch out this very simple sort of infidelity scenario, although it's unclear whether he's mourning the collapse of the marriage that the narrator of this song violated, or perhaps the other relationship that was briefly pursued, or perhaps both of them. We don't, really get any more specificity than that. But the song, it always gets me. The other one that I have, I think, of far lesser known than that, are the Wes Anderson movies I talked about. Smoke. It's funny that a movie that makes me cry is called Smoke, but there you go. It is a Wayne Wang, a Paul Auster film. Paul Auster, the novelist, the guy who wrote The Sheltering Sky, wrote the screenplay for this movie and co-directed this movie with Wayne Wang, centering around this group of characters that all hangs out at this cigar shop in Brooklyn owned by Harvey Keitel. There's a very young Harold Perrineau in this movie, Stockard Channing, a lot of great actors, Forrest Whitaker. But the movie sort of climaxes. And I don't think this is spoiling because it's in the execution,
sure.
not the event. But with Harvey Keitel and this beautiful monologue, I think it's all one take, where he's telling the story to this novelist who William Hurt plays, but he's clearly a stand-in for Paul Auster. His name is Paul, mm-hmm. and his character's name is Paul, who has been commissioned by the New York Times to write a Christmas story for publication on Christmas, and he's blocked. He doesn't know what to do. So Harvey Keitel tells him this sort of Shaggy Dog story about how he spent this one Christmas, wonderfully performed by Keitel. And then it gets the sense at the end that the novelist is moved but skeptical that this story is true. And then over the closing credits of the movie a few minutes later, we see this sort of silent film version of the story that Harvey Keitel has told, scored by the Tom Waits song You're Innocent When You Dream, where if ever there was just a title that might make you cry... It's this one, right? And that's the only audio. I saw this film in college and then didn't revisit it until a couple months ago. And I was a wreck over the end titles of this film and this Tom Waits song.
Yeah, Tom Waits' song, Down There by the Train, makes me cry. It's just this ultimate redemption song. And it's just one of the most generous lyrics ever written. Mm. Oh, my God, yeah.
How about you, Trey Graham? Do you have another one?
Well, speaking of redemption... I talked a little bit when I was talking about Sense and Sensibility about somebody who's done the right thing and suffers because of that and then gets rewarded. The middle ground for me is the sort of middle of my three things is when a very flawed person has managed to do the right thing and suffered for it and gets a glimpse at what the reward might be and then has to turn it down to do the right thing one more time. And that sounds a little specific.
I was just exactly going to say that sounds very specific.
If it sounds a little specific, it's because the thing that made me think of that is Eugene O'Neill's play Moon for the Misbegotten, which I saw on Broadway with Gabriel Byrne playing Jamie Tyrone, who's the same character from Long Day's Journey into Night, based on O'Neill's older brother. And as Josie, the heroine, the flawed person who does the right thing, Cherry Jones. And what happens is you discover that this woman loves this man, that he's always loved her, but he is so damaged, and he confesses to her such horrible things one night in a drunken stupor, that to protect him from the knowledge of his own confessions, she tells him that nothing happened the night they spent together.
Mm-hmm.
When she could have had a future with him,
mm-hmm.
she could have said yes and found this fractured, flawed future of love with this damaged person.
Sounds great.
Oh, God.
But he doesn't like dogs.
Oh, my God. This was one of those nights in the theater where I'm stifling sniffles and tears are running down my face. I realize that the audience around me is choking back sobs. And then at the curtain call, Cherry Jones walks out with tears streaming down her face, and the audience just completely loses its business. And everyone is weeping and gasping and cheering at the same time. It was so amazing.
You theater people.
It's... But that...
I can't help it.
It's not like I can mock.
I said ghosts.
None of us can.
I'm there in the theater usually sneering at the people who are crying.
Oh, my God. I am not an easy cry, but that one just... The combination of O'Neill, who takes 3 hours with this pedestrian language so often, this really on-the-nose mm-hmm. sort of dramaturgy, and you're like, in the my standard line about O'Neill is that he spends an hour making you go, oh, for God's sake, get on with it, and another hour making you go, people don't really talk like this, and in the third hour, he just wears you down with the sheer suffering and misery of these characters, and you break, and you give in, and you're like, oh, my God, it's so sad.
Well, that's awesome.
And that's my middle, which plugs into the third thing, which ties back to Linda's first thing, which is when I hear these chords. Those are the opening bars of the final number in Leonard Bernstein's Candide. So it's the Voltaire story, adapted for the stage. It is two people, Candide and Cunegonde, who have had all of their illusions stripped away by the random cruelties of a world that they think they were entitled to a place in. They have learned through much trial and much error that world, or at least its systems, to talk about something Linda was talking about the other week, couldn't care less about them. And they turn to each other, and they reach out to each other, and they decide to make a small place for themselves in that world nonetheless. Sadder, wiser, and kinder. Like Josie and Jamie in Moon for the Misbegotten, this is a moment that involves a profound gesture of forgiveness, but it also involves some self-knowledge, which is also in play in the O'Neill. Mostly, it involves understanding your own smallness in the face of infinity and valuing yourself and someone else for that smallness. It is just one of the most humane, beautiful stories ever. And its outlook on life is the one that moves me most deeply in any kind of pop culture.
I'm not making fun.
And then the number builds to this astonishing chorale. Everyone on stage just sort of wailing their faces off, and the orchestra playing, and then the orchestra drops out, and it's just the voices, and it's amazing.
Excellent. Well, I do want to say one other thing. The other thought I had is that there are certain things that I, because I've sung in a bunch of chorales and choirs and choruses and stuff like that, there's certain things that I don't have any problem listening to. But if I am singing them, especially in a group, but even in the car. I can listen to them, but I cannot cope with singing them. And you might be surprised, because it's not necessarily a sad thing that has this particular effect. It might be a different thing entirely. So, as you perhaps know, that is the end of the Hallelujah Chorus. And if that is playing in the car, typically around Christmas time, and I am singing with the Hallelujah Chorus in the car, I've done the alto part, I've done the soprano part, I know lots of different parts of various parts of the Messiah. But that is the one where if I'm singing with it in the car, by the end there, I'm just... Because I can't. Because I just can't. It's absolutely, absolutely remarkable. So please, I invite all of you. Open yourselves. Come and find us on Facebook. Tell us what you think.
Expose your fish-white, tear-stained bellies.
Your fish-white, tear-stained bellies.
Glenn is not here. Glenn is
and
not here.
Exactly. And we won't tell Glenn.
Yeah, Glenn is not here to stick a harpoon in it.
Exactly. And that brings us to our final segment. What is making us happy this week? Stephen Thompson, Whee! What is making
it's
you happy?
Hard turn.
What is making you happy this week?
A couple of things. One, last week, I had the opportunity to appear on a taping of the NPR program Ask Me Another. It is our fairly new quiz show hosted by Ophira Eisenberg. Jonathan Colton is their musical.
It's the house band.
Is the house band, the one man house band. Art Chung is their puzzle master. It's a delightful show, and as delightful a show as it is, it's even more fun to be in the room with it, mm-hmm. with the energy of it. The first weekend in November, they will air an episode that I am on as the onstage quiz-taking partner to Fugazi's Ian Mackay. He's from Fugazi and the Evens and Minor Threat and Teen Idols. Is a DC punk legend, and he and I take a quiz together, and in which I perform better than I did during the one that Linda and I recorded during the day for the staff, in which I am revealed to be a gigantic idiot.
That's not true.
We will more
to revealed.
Linda's being quite charitable, because when she came back to her desk after that, I said, "How'd you do?" She said, "Well, I wasn't as bad as Thompson."
I don't think I said that. I can't imagine I said that.
It was
that.
Something like
it's
that.
It's possible.
You certainly didn't humiliate yourself as spectacularly as I did.
Neither one of us had it.
Anyway, such a fun show, such a fun experience. We'll certainly throw up a link when that happens. The other thing is, over the weekend, I got a chance to finally take my children to see Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs 2.
Nice.
And the night before, because you know we really wanted to keep up with the intricate continuity, we watched Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs 1, which continues to be seriously one of the funniest movies of the
Steven's
last 10
years. Steven's new Kung Fu Panda.
Mm-hmm. It is my new Kung Fu Panda. But I mean, how many movie comedies are as funny as Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs?
Very many.
The second movie, I would say, is not as funny as the first one. It is not as funny, but it is more visually imaginative. And it is visually imaginative to the point where my mouth hung slack for almost...
Because you were hungry.
I was hungry.
Well, that whole sequence where they get to what you might describe as the lost world of foodimals is just amazing.
The amount of world building and wonderful world building that goes on in that second movie is something to behold. Like I said, not as many jokes as the first movie. And if you haven't seen the first movie and you just like laughing at movies, They're both terrific, and I got to spend the weekend rolling around in both of them.
All right. Thank you, Stephen Thompson. Trey Graham, what is making you happy this week, sir?
Three little things. The Nieman Journalism Lab has a thing called Annotation Tuesday, I believe it's called. And recently, on the 8th of October, they ran the annotated Gaetalese Frank Sinatra
yes,
Had a
they
Cold
did.
Article. Famous Esquire article in which Gaetalese interviews Frank Sinatra, who has a cold. And what happens in this series is that the interviewer takes the interviewee's seat and is asked by the Nieman Foundation what he was thinking, what he or she was thinking as this famous interview happened. So that's great. Also, the the recent 1 year anniversary of the Theater Development Fund's Theater Dictionary. It's a project spearheaded by my fellow theater nerd Mark Blankenship. Mm-hmm. And they marked the occasion of that 1 year anniversary by having Jinx Monsoon from RuPaul's Drag Race and the off-Broadway show The Vaudevillians define commedia dell'arte. This is a thing that is worth seeing. It is available on video, and if I remember, we will embed it in the blog post related to this show. And finally, today, just today, what landed on my desk, the book Song of Spider-Man, due out November 5th. Glenn Berger is the author. He co-wrote the book for Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark. Now he has written the book on that famously troubled show.
Mm-hmm.
I have only skimmed some of the more dramatic parts of the book at this point, but what I like about it so far is that it is conscious in that most terrible stretch where there are people falling out of the rafters and getting hurt. He's conscious that they are, and also people being dragged through the gutter and having their motivations questioned. He's always conscious that these are people, mm-hmm. and I think maybe that's my theme today. So Song of Spider-Man, due out November 5th.
Wonderful. Chris Klimek, what is making you happy this week?
Two things, both kind of in the same building. I was in New York over the weekend to see the Thrilling Adventure Hour podcast at the Bell House again, which has been praised on this show many times before, but you got to fill out the rest of the weekend.
Right.
So we went to the Museum of Modern Art. Dante Ferretti, Design and Construction for the Cinema, is an exhibit that's up there now. Dante Ferretti is perhaps the most celebrated production designer in movies now. He's worked for Fellini and Pasolini, Terry Gilliam, Tim Burton, Julie Taymor, kind of everybody. I think most recently his longest collaboration seems to be with Martin Scorsese. With the exception of The Departed, I think he has designed just about every Scorsese movie of the last 20 years. Starting with The Age of Innocence, which is probably where Trey and I have sort of overlapping Venn diagrams of taste in that movie. You know, but in a time when sets are increasingly being replaced by digital environments, as indeed, you know, creatures and models and miniatures have already been, just fascinating to see this master, you know, show off his sketches and just the environments and interiors and things that he's designed to create the world of these films. In the basement of MoMA there, they have this sort of labyrinth of screens hanging from the ceiling where they're projecting silent excerpts from about 24 of his films just on a continuous loop. And I could have just stayed down there all day. You know, I came back and reordered my Netflix queue because all these high design period Scorsese movies like The Aviator, you know, that I had sort of skipped when they were in theaters, or Gangs of New York, which I actually defended. He also designed the Francis Coppola Dracula from 1992, which I love. Right. I thought I was the only person who liked that movie.
No, it's a mixed movie, but talk about design.
It's visually amazing. And the fact that all of this visual effects and that are period effects using turn of the century technology is a thing I love about it. Anyway, if you can get yourself to New York the next couple of months, that exhibit, Dante Ferretti, Design and Construction for the Cinema, is up until February 9th. Then down in the gift shop, I found a book I had been unaware of, Juan Ortiz. It was an illustrator who's worked for Warner Brothers and Disney and various places, worked in comics a little bit. His new book is Star Trek, The Art of Juan Ortiz. He has gone back to the original 1960s Star Trek series, the one that I prefer, and done for each of the 80 episodes sort of a movie poster for each individual episode, sort of in the style of the great Saul Bass movie posters and title sequences of the 50s and 60s, bringing in elements of, like, Soviet propaganda. These are, you know, great, designy, visually compelling images if, you know, regardless of how you feel about Star Trek. But if you love it, you're especially going to love this. So that book is Star Trek, The Art of Juan Ortiz.
Fantastic. All right. Well, I have a quick and easy one this week. It is a broadcast television show, new one, which is officially my now favorite new fall show of this season, which is Trophy Wife. And it airs on ABC on Tuesday nights at 9:30. And this is the one that I think we spoke a little bit about before. It's co-created by Sarah Haskins, who did Target Women and some other really funny. She's a wonderful writer. It stars Bradley Whitford and Malin Ackerman as a man and his much younger third wife. The other two wives are played by Michaela Watkins, who used to be on Saturday Night Live, and Marcia Gay Harden. And it is really funny. The kids on it are funny. The people on it are funny. There is no bad guy. It is the ex-wives are decent people, but funny and odd. The young wife, the husband, they're all decent human beings, but funny and strange. And able to get into various sitcom scrapes, and I like it a lot, and I really want people to try it and watch it, because even though it has this dumb title, Trophy Wife, see also Cougar Town, it is much better and especially much different from what the title might suggest. So what is making me happy this week is there being a really funny new broadcast comedy that I like. I like certain other ones. I like Brooklyn Nine-Nine. There are other ones I'm still following, but that is my current favorite, and that is what is making me happy this week. That brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPRMonkeyC. You can follow Stephen at IDislikeStephen, STEPHEN. You can follow Trey at Trey Graham, Trey with an E, Graham like the cracker. You can follow Chris at, is it CT Klimek, Chris?
That's it. CTKLI. How do you spell my name?
MEK.
Yeah, there's a lime in the middle.
You can follow our producer, Nick Fountain, at Nick Fountain. Nick like Nick. Fountain like Fountain. You can follow our esteemed producer, emeritus, and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, KATZIF. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in and out music, which you are tapping your foot to right now. And if you dare, you can tell your tear stained stories to our absent pal, Glenn Weldon, at GH Weldon, WEL. D-O-N. So thanks to all of you for being here.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you back here next week.